I must say, I am a bit perplexed. Perplexed by the news that I have read recently about the appointment of a new state health director for the state of Missouri. I was under the impression that the news out of the state of Missouri, I won't call it my adopted home state, is merely the state in which I am employed. Whereas my adopted home state is Illinois, but I was under the impression that Missouri, especially after this last round of elections in November of 2002, had really made some strides forward with regard to the issue of a pro-life agenda. Well, read about last week's confirmation by the Missouri Senate. It was a close vote, but it was a vote nonetheless to confirm a pro-choice state health director. Of course, the governor doesn't seem too troubled by this. We'll find out what happened and how it took place in the first part of Issues Etc. today. Pam Manning will join us from Missouri Right to Life. When we're finished with our conversation with Pam, we'll be talking with Pastor Parker Williamson. He's editor-in-chief of the Presbyterian Layman, published in Lenoir, North Carolina. We'll be talking about the battle that did not take place and apparently will not take place for some time. The discussion, the debate over gay clergy in the Presbyterian Church USA. There was a scheduled special assembly which suddenly isn't going to take place. There were petition signatures. It was scheduled. It was ready to go. The topic, the agenda, gay issues in the Presbyterian Church. Now, it's not going to happen. We'll find out why. Although the debate will go on, we'll find out why in the second part of this hour. We'll have open lines a little bit in there from about 3:40 to 4:30. We'll have open lines for your questions and your comments. One of the things I'd like to discuss is President Bush. There are some who are saying that his faith is evolving. That is, he started out kind of as a Wesleyan, talking about his personal conversion. He speaks more and more as president about his own personal destiny, even being chosen by God for his position. We'll find out what you think about that during the open lines, Issues, etc., from about 3:30 to 4:30. And then at 4:30, we'll be joined by, who is it going to be? It's going to be James Dredke, Dr. James Dredke from the Zwemer Institute. Today is the last day of the Hajj, the pilgrimage. There's a story in the paper, you may have read it for yourself, in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Security is tight for Muslim pilgrimage. We'll find out what it is and why they do it. And then, during the last hour of the program, Pastor Tom Baker will join us. This will be, what, part four, part five? It's already there. My goodness, this time flies with Tom. It's a seven-part series we're doing on the theology of glory versus the theology of the cross. Today, what is the relationship between utter despair and saving faith? Pastor Tom Baker joins us in the last hour of the program. Pam Manning is president of Missouri Right to Life. Pam, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Well, thank you. It's very nice to be here. I wish it was under better circumstances.
As do I. Tell us, how did this happen in a state that is, by all accounts, Missouri is a leader in the pro-life movement, especially on how it elects its lawmakers. How did we get a pro-choice state health director? Who is he and what happened?
Well, his name is Mr. Richard Dunn. And he has directed some other state programs, I believe. I do not know Mr. Dunn. And he has been acting director since the last director resigned. And so he came up for confirmation before this in the Missouri Senate. And on Wednesday, he was approved by the committee who hears gubernatorial appointments. He was only approved, though, after he was grilled relentlessly by Senator John Loudon of St. Louis County on his position on funding for Planned Parenthood and their family planning program. This has been a very contentious issue in Missouri for as long as the program has existed. Over whether Planned Parenthood would be allowed to receive funds for their family planning program, not their abortion mill. The legislature has said no, the Attorney General has said yes, and the Attorney General, being the Attorney General, has prevailed over the wishes of the people of Missouri and the legislature of Missouri. So that's kind of the background on Mr. Dunn, who was questioned about how he would act, because he's the one who administers those dollars. And he said he would In answer, he would follow the Attorney General's directions. And this rather came up, oh, I don't know if suddenly is the right word, but the knowledge of his, what he would do came up. We became aware of it on Wednesday during this committee hearing. And Missouri Right to Life, because of that, opposed his confirmation, but he was confirmed by the committee and by the full Senate then on Thursday. So that's kind of the background on it.
Now, you had mentioned the Missouri State Attorney and his involvement in this Planned Parenthood funding case.
Yes.
If I remember correctly, there was kind of a confusing period there in the middle of 2002 where the state attorney was trying to kind of take both sides of this issue, and he was told he had to pick a side, and of course he picked the side for funding. Is that basically the story here?
That's basically the story. Judge Kinder has, from Missouri, he's Missouri State, well, I'm not going to probably say this right, but he's in the Missouri court system. Let me put it that way so that I don't mess up what he actually is. But he has said that the legislature had the power to decide how they wanted state funds used. And that is the typical way that money is allocated, is by the legislature. And he had said they had the power to deny the money to Planned Parenthood because of Planned Parenthood's involvement with abortion, their abortion mill that they have here in St. Louis. And then they have one in Columbia also that they just recently reopened. And so it went up to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court gave it back to Attorney General Nixon and said, you have to decide what to do with this because you can't represent both sides. Basically, that's the story. And so then Jay Nixon decided he would drop the case, and that left the funding, and then Planned Parenthood was given money last fall, I believe, for last year. But the courts, frankly, have found in favor of the legislature. Oops, I'm sorry. We're just going to ignore that. The courts have found in favor of the legislature, but there's no one who will enforce it, basically.
We're talking $600,000 recently awarded to Planned Parenthood for family planning. Is this money for abortions?
This is not technically money for abortion because in Missouri state law says that the state will not pay for abortions. And so it's money supposedly for family planning. But because they run their abortion mill and their family planning services out of the same building, it was felt that they were probably subsidizing the abortion business with the family planning money. And when they did lose that money temporarily, they had to close the Columbia, Missouri business because while Columbia does abortions and also does family planning, they didn't have enough money to keep the place open when they lost their family planning money. That was pretty clear indication that, yes, indeed, the family planning money does subsidize their abortion business.
Now, you said before that Dunn, the newly appointed pro-choice state health director, has said he will continue the state attorney's policy on funding for Planned Parenthood. What exactly does that mean?
Well, as far as we can determine, he's going to go ahead and give them the money. So what that is done through the budget appropriation every year. And so as a result, they're coming back to this family planning funding again now as they're beginning to consider next year's budget for the state of Missouri. And, of course, they're very short of money this year. Everybody knows that. That's all we hear on the news. And I have heard a few senators and say that this money should just zero out the family planning money. It's not a very old program. It was initiated by Governor Carnahan without any legislative approval in 1993, I believe. And so it's not a long-standing program. And there have been legislators who have said that money should just be zeroed out because they need it in the state budget anyway. And certainly better to take it from there than family, than education from the schools. So there's been that discussion. I don't think that will happen myself. It's just my personal opinion. But they will again. So the legislature now is trying to figure out a way that they can, if they approve family planning money, again, they want to keep it out of the hands of Planned Parenthood and any other abortion provider that also wants family planning money.
How did the full Senate vote on the approval of Richard Dunn?
I believe it was 20-13, I believe. I have the vote right here. I should have pulled it out before you called, Todd. I believe it would. Let me just look. As I say, though, Senator John Loudon from the St. Louis County and Senator John Dolan from St. Charles County, Lake St. Louis area, were both very good on the floor debate and were very supportive of the pro-life position and were very concerned about confirming this man because of his statements at the committee hearing on Wednesday. They attempted to send the nomination back to the committee for further talk with Mr. Dunn, but the full Senate voted that down. There is a time frame in which these appointments must be approved, and I believe it's 30 days, and Thursday was the last day for approval. So if they had sent it back to committee, it would have technically died, and the governor would have had to renominate him. Now, that's not uncommon for that to happen. So the 30-day period was really, really not germane to the whole argument. It could have been done easily. But that was the first motion before the Senate in this confirmation hearing, and that was voted down by a vote of 23-10. And then they went on and took the vote to confirm him, and that vote was 20 yay and 13 no.
Does this 20 yay, 13 nay, does it represent the pro-choice, pro-life split in the Missouri Senate?
Oh, no. No, because there were many what we still certainly consider pro-life senators who voted to confirm. And the obvious next question, Todd, is why did they do that?
Yes, that's my next question.
A couple of things that I saw working here. One was the idea that this is a good man who's a good administrator and that we're going to figure out a way that will uphold the legislative wishes that the money not go to Planned Parenthood through the budget process. So we'll go ahead and confirm him. Another way they could do it is to put it actually into statute so that this question doesn't come up every year. And there are legislators that are looking at ways to do that effectively. But that's one reason. They said, well, we're going to figure this out so it won't be a problem. But the thing you have to consider when you say that is that any kind of pro-life legislation that becomes law, such as the informed consent for women considering abortions, which is before the legislature this year, if that would become law, or anything to the end of life issues, such as pain relief legislation, and so all of those would be administered by the Department of Health. So it's not just a question, it's not only the family planning money where you want a pro-life or at least a fair director. There's many pro-life questions that come before that department. The other thing I heard as this debate was going on was, well, Governor Holden isn't going to send us anybody pro-life. So if we don't confirm Richard Dunn, we will just be facing this question over and over because he's never going to send us anybody that's, you know, going to follow the lead of the legislature and not the Attorney General.
And that's kind of the better the devil you know argument here. Better that
Absolutely. We
approve this guy than we get someone worse in the next go-round. Dunn has said at least that he will conduct an audit of Planned Parenthood's financial activities to make sure that they're complying with the legislative directives of the Missouri Senate and House.
That's what he said.
Are you confident of this?
I don't know Mr. Dunn at all, so it's difficult for me to say. I frankly do know that before all these questions came up, one day before he was confirmed, that people spoke highly of him as an honorable, honest man who had done good things in this state, who had worked closely with some nursing home questions and helped to resolve them and so forth. So I think that, no, I don't like that argument at all. I think that when you have someone of Mr. Dunn's pronouncements, and he was very clear about what he would do, that you just can't confirm him. But I wasn't, sadly, I wasn't voting in the Senate. So as I say, we had many of the pro-life senators that did vote as Missouri Right to Life would have hoped, but we had some that did not.
Pam Manning, thank you very much for being our guest.
Absolutely.
The most we can say here is that time will tell. Folks, if you'd like to contact Missouri Right to Life, you can do so either via the internet at missourilife.org, that's missourilife.org, or you can also call them at area code 573-635-5110. That's 573 area code 635-5110. Pam Manning is president of Missouri Right to Life. We'll be talking now with Pastor Parker Williamson. This is another story that I've been following. The story's come across my desk on a number of occasions. It looked as though the Presbyterian Church USA was going to hold a special assembly in order to talk about one issue and one issue alone, and that would have been gay clergy, the ordination of active homosexuals, lesbians, and gays in their midst. It looked like it was ready to go. There were petitions, there were news releases, and then suddenly it isn't going to happen. And we'll find out why now as we talk with Pastor Parker Williamson, editor-in-chief of the Presbyterian Layman, published in Lenore, North Carolina. Pastor Williamson, welcome back.
Hello, Todd. It's good to hear your voice.
Tell us the whole story here from beginning to end about how this special assembly was put together and how it is it was taken apart.
Well, Todd, back in 1996, the Presbyterian Church USA, at its General Assembly level, enacted standards, ordination standards, into our Constitution. And those standards include the fact that we will not ordain or install any person into the ministry, among our elders, who openly engages in sex outside of marriage. That certainly means homosexual persons. It also means persons engaged in adultery. And that passed. It has been challenged a number of times. And the last time it was challenged, last year, we beat back that challenge 3-1. The people of this church clearly want that standard to stay in the Constitution. But what's happened is that the infrastructure of the Presbyterian Church USA apparently has no intention of enforcing the Constitution. People put it in there and have kept it in there by a 3-1 vote, but the administrative offices, the courts of the Presbyterian Church, are doing nothing to enforce that and to see to it that ministers, elders, sessions comply with that Constitution. And it's gotten so bad, the defiance has happened in so many places, that a doctor by the name of Alexander Metherell from out in California, Laguna Beach, California, who was a commissioner to the last General Assembly, decided to see if he couldn't get enough commissioners together to force a called meeting of the General Assembly. It's never happened in the history of the denomination. The purpose of the called meeting being to look at these incidents of defiance and to call upon the leadership of this denomination to ensure compliance with the Constitution. So what he had to have was 50 petitions or signatures on a petition, 25 ministers and 25 elders from 15 presbyteries across the denomination. He came up with 57, for seven more than he needed, and they came from every synod in the denomination, some 40-something presbyteries, so it's very broad across the denomination. On January 14, he walked into a meeting in Louisville, Kentucky, denominational headquarters, shocked everybody by walking into the meeting, and handed those 57 petitions, all hand-signed, to the moderator of the General Assembly. And all just chaos broke loose in the place. The news services raced for their cameras and started taking notes, and the meeting was recessed, and the moderator and the stated clerk went off into a huddle. Now, what the Constitution says is that when presented with these petitions, it says the moderator shall call the meeting. Not may or might, but shall.
The special assembly.
The special assembly.
Okay. What happened?
Well, the moderator said, well, my goodness, we're going to have to see and verify these signatures and see if they're real. So he and the study clerk pulled off in a corner, and he wrote a letter to these 57 commissioners pleading with them, imploring them to withdraw their names. Now, this is especially significant among the minister commissioners who are there. Here they're getting a letter from the moderator of the General Assembly not saying, because you sent this petition, I'm going to call the meeting, but saying, I implore you for the peace of the church, for the good of the church, please take your name off. That's terrific pressure on a minister. After all, he's got his job to think about. And so they did that. And then the stated clerk of the assembly wrote all these commissioners and said, now, we've heard that you signed this petition, but we want to verify this and make sure, and we certainly hope that you paid attention to what the moderator said, and lots of pressure on it. And then finally he said, I want you to sign the thing below. I do not want a General Assembly special meeting. In other words, he put it to them to vote again. Well, under that kind of pressure, and we've also found that there have been executives, and all these regional executives have been calling, particularly the ministers among those 57, saying, you know what, it really is not in your best interest to have your name on a petition like this. We encourage you to take it off. 13 people took their names off. And so then the moderator and the stated clerk announced at a news conference that there would be no call meeting because not enough people had signed petitions.
All right, we're going to take a break. And when we come back from this break, we're going to continue this conversation with Pastor Parker Williamson, editor-in-chief of the Presbyterian Layman, published in Lenore, North Carolina. Now, the Presbyterian Church USA is the largest Presbyterian church body in the United States. There's a lot of, well, he calls it defiance of that church's constitution, its policy on the ordination of active gays and homosexuals. And a lot of difference between the hierarchy of the church, the administrative offices of the church, and the lay people. We'll find out more about that. We'll find out whether or not the Presbyterian Church USA, given the fact that its leadership is willing basically to go around the Constitution, if necessary, to not talk about this, whether or not they will talk about this, and whether or not they will come out and support what the lay people and the ministers of the Presbyterian Church USA have voted overwhelmingly to enact in their constitution. Pastor Parker Williamson, editor-in-chief of the Presbyterian Layman, published in Lenore, North Carolina. We'll get the rest of this story when we come back from this break. Then a reminder, Open Lines follows this conversation. Stay with us.
A voice in the wilderness of American evangelicalism. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Are marketing principles compatible with Christian evangelism? Can Christianity be marketed like Coca-Cola, Ford, or Chevy? And how much have business practices influenced the Christian church? You'll find answers to these questions with the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for February, Testing the Claims of Church Growth. The book is published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. Or you can find out more about this book on our website, issuesetc.org, and click the What's New section, issuesetc.org. Testing the Claims of Church Growth is written by a former marketing executive and now pastor, Rod Zwanitzer. Testing the Claims of Church Growth, our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for February. For more information, call Concordia Publishing House at 1-800-325-3040. That's 1-800-325-3040.
Now this Global Minute focuses on the Philippine capital of Manila, where missionaries are working creatively with the poorest of the poor. Missionary Mike Waters with Action International Ministries started a new church right where squatters and shacks and homeless children survived. Today, about 20 families and 50 or more street children attend the church. Here are some strategies they're using to assist families and improve their quality of life. Bible studies and discipleship, teaching men how to drive so they can get jobs to provide for their families, and forming an education program to help the poorest children attend school. In addition, camping and medical clinics round out the ministry. Pray for Mike and his team, which includes Filipino Christians. Ask Christ to give them wisdom in teaching the Bible. Pray also for the people they're reaching to have the confidence as they learn new skills. Pray for creative outreaches by logging on to www.actionintl.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. On this date, February 11th, 1861, the day before his 52nd birthday, Abraham Lincoln left his hometown of Springfield, Illinois, to travel by train to Washington to assume the presidency. After speaking of his oppressive sadness at parting, Lincoln spoke words that remain true today for us and for our nation. "Today I leave you. I go to assume a task more difficult than that which devolved upon General Washington. Unless the great God who assisted him shall be with me and aid me, I must fail. But if the same omniscient mind and almighty arm that directed and protected him shall guide and support me, I shall not fail, I shall succeed. Let us all pray that the God of our fathers may not forsake us now. To him I commend you all. Permit me to ask that with equal security and faith, you all will invoke his wisdom and guidance for me. With these few words I must leave you, for how long I know not. Friends, one and all, I must now bid you an affectionate farewell."
Sign on at 7 a.m. Wake up with inspiration, information, and Diane Summers while I'm away. Hi, this is Paul Clayton. I'll get back from vacation on Thursday, but in the meantime, listen for our regular guests and features, like Steve Coleman with Religion News and his Closer Look, Dr. Dale Meyer and the Meyer Minute, plus that AM 850 KFUO Daily Bible Quiz on the morning show on AM 850 KFUO.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we continue our series with Dr. Ken Sherb of Zion Lutheran Church in Moberly, Missouri. We've gone through God the Father, God the Son. Tomorrow it's the person and work of the Holy Spirit, God the Spirit. And we'll have part three of our seven-part series on testing the truth claims of Christianity with our good friend and regular guest, Christian apologist and law professor, Dr. John Warwick Montgomery. That's tomorrow on Issues Etc. For the next few minutes, we'll be continuing our conversation, getting an update on the battle over gay clergy in the Presbyterian Church USA with Pastor Parker Williamson. He is editor-in-chief of the Presbyterian Layman. It's published in Lenore, North Carolina. Now, if you'd like information on how to receive the Presbyterian Layman, if you're one of those PCUSA lay people who is deeply disturbed about the shenanigans and the goings-on of your leadership in Louisville, you can call them at 1-800-368-0110. That's 1-800-368-0110. Or you can check out the website for the Presbyterian Layman at layman.org. Layman, LAYMAN.org. Their number again, 1-800-368-0110. Parker, how does it stand now? Now that the moderator has seen to it that this assembly will not take place, seen to it that he has pressured those who signed the petitions to remove enough of them to remove their names so that the petition, I guess, is invalidated. How does it stand now?
Well, Todd, it's going into the Presbyterian courts now. The fact of the matter is that the Constitution doesn't make any provision for people to withdraw their names. I mean, it's like having if you have an election and people vote and the outcome is announced, and then somebody comes to you and says, Todd, would you go back there and withdraw your vote? I mean, that's just not done. It's not done in petition campaigns either. And there's no provision for it in the Constitution. So what the moderator and city clerk have done is utterly illegal. Once those 57 commissioners signed the petition and it was delivered, that petition is valid and stands. And that's the argument that is being used by a church, Westminster Presbyterian Church in Canton, Ohio. And that church, the session of that church, the governing body, has filed charges against the moderator and the stated clerk, saying you have defied the Constitution, and asking the highest court in the Presbyterian Church to overturn their action and to immediately call this special session of the General Assembly. And that matter, there'll be preliminary hearings on that at the end of this month, somewhere 26, 27, 28 February. We're not sure just exactly when.
Why don't these church leaders adhere to their own rules?
Well, that's an amazing thing. I mean, the stated clerk of the General Assembly, in the manual of the Assembly, his job description, the first item is that he will protect and preserve the Constitution of the Presbyterian Church USA. And all these commissioners are doing is asking that an assembly be held so that he can be held accountable to his duty. And obviously he doesn't want that to happen. He doesn't want the embarrassment of a special meeting of the General Assembly to tell him to do his job. Why doesn't he do it? I have to conclude. I simply must conclude that this stated clerk does not want the Constitution to be enforced. And that he has taken aside, along with persons in this denomination who want to see the standards of this denomination reduced, the moral standards of our ordained leadership undermined.
Now, as it stands now, what you spoke before about defiance of the Constitution, of the policy that the Presbyterian Church USA has again and again by vote upheld about gay clergy, what can a minister, a candidate for ordination in the Presbyterian Church USA, what can he get away with now, given the fact that apparently officialdom there will not allow this to be discussed officially?
Well, I'll give you an example. In Baltimore Presbytery, there's a fellow there by the name of Don Stroud. Don Stroud has declared quite openly on a website, in writing, he's declared that he is a homosexual, and that he is engaged in a relationship with another male, and he flaunted this before the Presbyterian Church, and so a member of the Presbyterian Church filed charges against him for defiance of his ordination vows. And when that matter came to Baltimore Presbytery, the court there, that's a lower-level court, but the entry-level court at the Presbytery, simply refused to hear the case. And the Presbytery then had a meeting, and it went further and said, we encourage our court not to entertain any case which calls for the enforcement of that part of the Constitution.
So in other words, rather than the Constitution being read as it has been approved by the entire Presbyterian Church USA, they are simply saying, we're just not going to take cases that deal with this particular part of our... This, for all intents and purposes, doesn't exist.
That's right. They're saying, in that particular presbytery, they're saying that part of the Constitution we simply will not obey, it doesn't apply, and we will not enforce it, and we will not prosecute anybody who violates it. They have our protection here. Now, you know, that in effect means you don't have a constitution anymore. I remember years ago when during the civil rights struggle, you probably can tell from my voice that I'm a Southerner, and I remember very well Central High School in Little Rock, Arkansas, when there was a declaration, in spite of the fact that black children were to be allowed to go to school there. It was a declaration of the administration, backed up by the state government, that they would not allow blacks to come there. And the President of the United States, Eisenhower, at that point, understood that if that was allowed, we would no longer have a constitution. And he went in there, and I remember the soldiers lined up on either side of that sidewalk to allow those little black girls to go to school there. And I thought he was exactly right. When you turn your back on a defiance of the Constitution, as interpreted by the courts, then in effect, you've declared that we no longer have a Constitution. And that's where we are in the Presbyterian Church today, unless this matter can be dealt with by the people.
Will there eventually be a special assembly to deal with the issue of gay clergy in the Presbyterian Church USA?
I wouldn't bet on it, because one of the problems that we're facing is that the court system, the administration of the court system in the Presbyterian Church, is under the office of, you guessed it, the stated clerk. So I fully expect to see some technicalities pulled here that will keep that case that was filed by Westminster Presbyterian Church from ever going to trial. But, I hope I'm wrong, but things don't look good here. We clearly have a statement of the people of this church. We clearly have a constitutional ordination standard, and we have an infrastructure that is doing everything in its power to keep that from being adjudicated.
When will the next regular assembly be for the Presbyterian Church USA? Do you think that this issue will be brought up or even perhaps resolved in some sense?
I suspect that it will be. It will be held in May. I don't have the exact date in front of me, but about mid-May. And I rather think that it will be discussed at that General Assembly. The problem of that is that a General Assembly meets for 1 week and they have a huge amount of business. They have budget matters to deal with. And in the Presbyterian Church, we're losing members at the rate of 30,000 to 40,000 members a year. And the budgets are in serious trouble. There are deficits everywhere you turn. And the General Assembly, when it meets, it has a huge amount of business to take care of. And this would only be one item that these very weary General Assembly commissioners would have to deal with. The wisdom of that special call meeting of the General Assembly is that a call meeting can only deal with the one item of business that they've been called to deal with. So we would have had commissioners coming together for the sole purpose of focusing on the constitutional crisis in this church and coming up with an answer to it. Now it's going to be one of many items before the commissioners, and a huge number of staff people comes to that meeting of the General Assembly and lobbies it. Almost as many staff people as there are elected commissioners.
Now, I've asked you this before many times, Parker, to the person sitting in a conservative church body who says, look, we're on the straight and narrow. This could never happen to us. We could never go so far as the Presbyterian Church USA seems to have gone. What is your response?
Well, Todd, my response is if you look at church history, you see there are periods in the life of the church that go all the way back in which the church was plagued with leadership that defied the gospel, that turned its back on Scripture, that created an institution that was not the church, though it carried the church's name. And when those times have come in history, thank God, the Spirit of God has moved among the people to bring about a reformation and to cleanse this bride of Christ that has been encrusted in an institution that defies his name. And I can only pray for that. I know that God has done it in the past, and I know that he will again, because he promised us when he built his church, he promised us that the gates of hell would not prevail against it. I don't know if the Presbyterian Church USA can survive. That institution may go the way of many institutions that have defied their purpose. But I do believe that God will act among these Presbyterian Christians to keep his witness alive.
Parker Williamson, thank you very much for being our guest again here on Issues, Etc.
Thank you, Todd. It's great to be with you.
Folks, I know that we have a lot of Presbyterian Church USA members who listen to this program. I'd like your reaction to the rejection of this special assembly of the PCUSA. If you're a member of this church body, and your church body were to continue the direction it seems to be going, and eventually, by hook or crook or by action or by official vote, approve actively gay clergy, what would you do? Would you leave? The phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. The remainder of this hour and the first part of the next hour are open lines for your questions and your comments. Our guest has been Pastor Parker Williamson, editor-in-chief of the Presbyterian Layman, published in Lenoir, North Carolina. You can reach them toll-free, 1-800-368-0110, or on the web at layman.org. That's LAYMAN.org. 1-800-368-0110. It's open lines. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. After about 45 minutes of open lines, we'll be talking with Dr. James Dretke, director of the Zwemer Institute for Muslim Studies, based in Fort Wayne, Indiana, about the Muslims' annual pilgrimage to Mecca and Mount Arafat. It's in the newspaper. That's coming up after open lines. Very recently, the president was at a prayer breakfast, President George W. Bush, and he was quite open about the role of prayer in his life and in his administration as the president. Now, one would expect him to wax religious as he's at a prayer breakfast. There are those who are tracking the president's various statements with regard to prayer, his faith, his statements of a religious nature in his official speeches, even coming out of the White House. And they say that they are finding an evolution in the president's theology. There's an article on beliefnet.com called "An Evolving Faith: Does the President Believe He Has a Divine Mandate?" I'd like your reaction to this as well. The author of that article, Deborah Caldwell, says, "We are witnessing a shift in Bush's theology from talking mostly about a Wesleyan theology of personal transformation to describing a Calvinist divine plan laid out by a sovereign God for the country and himself." And she says, "The shift has the potential to affect Bush's approach to terrorism, Iraq, and his presidency." She quotes President George W. Bush at the National Prayer Breakfast on Thursday last week, where President said, "We can be confident in the ways of providence behind all life and all history. There's a dedication and purpose set by the hand of a just and faithful God." Now, of course, people would expect him to make statements like this at a prayer breakfast. Virtually any president that was at a national prayer breakfast would probably make some passing reference to God. But Deborah Caldwell goes on to say that Bush has made several statements indicating he believes God is involved in world events and that he and America have a divinely guided mission. She cites a few. Here they are. After Bush's September 20th, 2001 speech to Congress, that of course came right on the heels of September 11th, a special assembly of both houses where the president spoke, Bush's speechwriter, Mike Gerson, called the president and said, "Mr. President, when I saw you on television, I thought God wanted you there. He wants us all here, Gerson," the president responded. Another instance in Caldwell's list of why the president may think he has a divine mandate, during that speech, September 20th, 2001, the president said, "Freedom and fear, justice and cruelty have always been at war, and we know that God is not neutral between them." Caldwell says the implication is that God will intervene on the world stage, mediating between good and evil. At the prayer breakfast, during which he talked about God's impact on history, the president also said that he felt, quote, the presence of the Almighty while comforting the families of the shuttle astronauts during the Houston Memorial Service last week Tuesday. And in his State of the Union address from last month, the president said that we place confidence in the loving God, quote, behind all life and all history, and that, quote, we go forward with confidence because this call of history has come to the right country. May he guide us now. Now, herein, Deborah Caldwell finds evidence that Bush believes that his election as president is the result of God's act. I want to know what you think about this. This is a fair reading of the president's statements. She goes on, actually, to quote from World Magazine, where Tim Gagelein, who is the deputy director of White House Public Liaison, saying this, I think President Bush is God's man at this hour, and I say this with a great sense of humility. In addition, Time Magazine also reported privately, Bush even talked of being chosen by the grace of God to lead at that moment. Now, Robin Lovin, a United Methodist ethicist, and by the way, the president is a member of United Methodist Church. I don't know how Methodist his theology is. Who could tell? But Robin Lovin, the United Methodist ethicist and professor of religion and political thought at Southern Methodist University in Dallas, said this, all sorts of warning signals ought to go off when a sense of personal chosenness and calling gets translated into a sense of calling and mission for a nation. He says the president seems to be lacking theological humility and an awareness of moral ambiguity. On the other hand, the likes of Richard Land find encouragement in what the president has been saying. Land says, we really believe that some things are good and some things are bad. It's even possible, he says, that Bush's belief in America's moral rightness makes the country's military threats even more genuine because the world thinks Bush is, quote, on a mission. Now, the presidents have always used scripture. We've talked about this many times here on Issues, etc., in order to make their points. Lincoln, of course, was probably the first president to use the Bible extensively in his speeches. But one of the main reasons, according to a Harvard Kennedy School of Government professor, that Lincoln used the Bible in his speeches was that his audience knew the Bible. Lincoln was using what was then kind of common parlance. Theodore Roosevelt, in his 1912 speech to the Progressive Party, closed with these words, we stand at Armageddon, and we battle for the Lord. Now, I don't think Bush could get away with that. But of course, Theodore Roosevelt could get away with just about anything. I'd elect him again. Someone find a way of cloning Teddy, and we'll bring him back. Carter, Reagan, Clinton all used scripture, but the professor at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government says that their use was more a grace tone. Bush is different, he says, because he uses theology as the guts of his argument. That's very unusual in the long sweep of American history. The president says he was inspired to run for office by a sermon that he heard delivered by the Reverend Mark Craig, pastor of Bush's Dallas congregation, Highland Park United Methodist Church. He's very open about this. In the end, Dr. C. Welton Gaddy, president of the Interfaith Alliance, says, sometimes President Bush comes close to crossing the line of trying to serve the nation as its religious leader rather than its political leader. And at the end of this article, Deborah Caldwell recalls the president's inaugural address. And she says, in hindsight, even the inaugural address presaged his emerging theological emphasis as president. He quoted a columnist who wrote to Thomas Jefferson that, quote, we know the race is not to the swift nor the battle to the strong. Do you not think an angel rides in the whirlwind and directs the storm? Bush then said this. Now reflect upon this. This is 2020 retrospect. But maybe Caldwell's made her case here. This is what the president said at his inaugural address. Much time has passed since Jefferson arrived for his inauguration. The years and changes accumulate, but the themes of this day he would know. Our nation's grand story of courage and its single dream of dignity. We are not this story's author. who fills time and eternity with His purpose. Yet His purpose is achieved in our duty, and our duty is fulfilled in service to one another. Never tiring, never yielding, never finishing, we renew that purpose today to make our country more just and generous, to affirm the dignity of our lives in every life. This work continues, this story goes on, and an angel still rides in the whirlwind and directs this storm. Caldwell concludes that perhaps there's more of theology in Bush's rhetoric and politics than might first appear. Although you might say the same case could have been made for President Bill Clinton, who was rather prolific in his quotations of Scripture. Seldom did he deliver a major speech where he didn't make at least a sidelong mention, an oblique reference to something in Scripture. He drew upon its themes on a regular basis. And people could probably excuse it, saying, well, President Bill Clinton was a product of the South, a product of the Bible Belt. This is the bread and butter of how people talk. He was simply borrowing images that would have been familiar with his culture. What do you think? Are you encouraged, discouraged, or you just don't care about the president's emphasis? He has been a president for the last 2 years, without a doubt, during time of great crisis. It seems that about every 6 months, another crisis arises for this country in which he has acted as not only president, but also kind of national comforter. What kind of a job do you think he's done? Do you want the president to exercise what some people might say is almost pastoral leadership? Or would you prefer he remain president? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. We are coming up on a break here at the bottom of, at the top of the hour, and it will, we'll continue with open lines for about 25 minutes after the break. You can call us during this break, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. The death penalty is also on the table, by the way. There's an op-ed piece in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch titled The Death of Innocence, in which the editorial board of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch takes on Attorney General Jay Nixon for saying that the Supreme Court says even if a person is probably innocent, they should probably still be executed. And the Federal Appeals Court in St. Louis ruled, was it just yesterday? Yes, just yesterday, that officials in Arkansas can force a prisoner on death row to take antipsychotropic medications to make sure he's sane enough to be executed. We'll talk about all of that when we come back.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.